Okay, so we're in Genesis 48 and 49 tonight, and then next week we'll do Genesis 50 and have a wrap-up, okay? And after that, Larry is going to swing up from Sunday mornings on to Wednesday nights and begin teaching on Wednesday nights, and Joe Riley is going to be teaching Sunday mornings for the next little bit. And so that's kind of where we're going as a group, and look forward to both of those. All right. When we look at Genesis chapter 48, we talked a little bit about this last week, but I'd like to kind of expound on it a little bit more. And that's the idea of God's generosity. When Jacob had the news years before this, over 20 years before this, more than likely, that Joseph was dead, he never thought that he would ever see Joseph again. And you look at the tragedy of that, because Jacob, number one, lived the remainder of his adult years in Canaan missing that integral part of his life. You know, his firstborn with Rachel, who was the woman he loved. And Joseph grew up without his father. And when you look at young teenage boys at age 16, losing their father figure and their godly influence in their life, especially someone of the character by that time of Jacob in his godliness, very different than the Jacob that left Canaan and went to Laban's, as we've seen. It does something to young boys not to have that kind of influence. It seems that God provided Joseph some guidance through other individuals and men that he was in contact with, not the least of which was the jailer in the Egyptian prison. He found favor with that man, and that man took care of Joseph. And we don't know what all was involved with him taking care of that young man, but God saw to it. And then we see the outcome of that when we see Joseph's character was just exemplary, would it not be, in these last few chapters? But in chapter 48, we see that Jacob is aware that his life in so many ways has been an offense to God. But now he realizes God has been graciously working all along, and that God was better to him than he ever deserved. You know, when we look at where Jacob began and his personality and his characteristics, they weren't the best, were they? I mean, what does his name even mean? Jacob means what? Well, no. God gave him that name later, but the word Jacob means what? The supplanter. All right. So, what does that mean? I have to keep poking at it until I hear a word that I'm familiar with. What does supplanter mean? If you supplant someone or something, what are you doing? Yeah. You ever have somebody get in a line of traffic and it says one lane ahead, construction, and everybody's lined up trying to get into the single file lane, and there's one guy that runs all the way to the front and slams it in at the last minute and tries to jam it in, right? When they had plenty of warning to do this, and they're the ones that are pushing the barrels with their bumper so they can get just a few more feet before they have to merge over. Okay, that's called supplanting, Connie. If you're guilty, then maybe your middle name should be Jacob. Jacobina. We'll start calling Connie Jacobina. Okay? And they're generally driving a blue BMW around town if you see it. Right, Connie? All right. But that's kind of what it means. It means to supplant. It means to uproot. It means to put your stuff in the place of what was there before when it didn't have a right to be first. And so he went through his whole life trying to be first, trying to be first, trying to be first. You see that in kids, you know? You see that in kids and children behavior a lot, right? And when you line up in school, in grade school, in kindergarten, there's always a few kids that always want to line up first. They're always elbowing. And if you've ever ridden the metro at rush hour in D.C., there's a whole lot of that. Because if it gets full, you have to wait till the next one. And you don't want to wait till the next one. Not that that person doesn't have just as many reasons to get on than you do, but you don't care about that. It's all about who? It's all about me. Jacob was very self-centered at the beginning. Now, did he have a right to be self-centered? Think about that. What would cause Jacob to be motivated to think perhaps that he did have a right to that? He's third generation now.
Because God had, said that through their seed that,
Mm-hmm. And who received or got to receive that blessing? Yeah. He was going to be the one to get it, and he, in fact, did get it. And he's the third generation to receive that promise. And so it seems to be instilled in his upbringing and background, this idea of entitlement, perhaps. And that's not unusual to see in people sometimes manifest itself. And so Jacob began there, but when we see this Jacob here in chapter 48 and 49 and these blessings he gives to his sons, and a few of the verses that talk about Jacob's worshiping God in these chapters, you get a very different picture of a man. Now, here is an older man. He blesses Pharaoh with great gracefulness. He probably, I wouldn't doubt, walks with a bit of a limp from when he had his hip thrown out of joint, from wrestling with the angel of God when his name was changed when he returned to the land. You know, you just don't get over some of those kinds of injuries. A hip displacement of that biggest joint in your body, tremendously painful. And it might very well have carried on in its effect on him as a reminder, perhaps, every day of that event. Sometimes we need reminding every day. I had a bad ski accident years ago that ultimately wound up with me having to have shoulder surgery. And the fellow that was a good friend of mine that ran me over on the ski slope was a whole lot bigger than me, okay? And he played semi-professional. He was kind of a Travis Elliott. He was kind of that size. Played semi-professional baseball and was kind of the linebacker size. And he just pulled a Joe Theismann on me. Remember when Joe Theismann got his leg broken in that game against the New York Giants and Lawrence Taylor blindsided him and just broke his leg in half? Well, that's kind of the way that felt that day. And so we had, you know, ski stuff all over the slope. It was a yard sale, we said. And I have go through the rest of my life. And I talk like it was yesterday, and it was actually, 30 years ago. But most days, I don't go through the entire day without thinking of David Brown. Because David Brown is the one that ran me over, and my shoulder hurts just a little bit almost every day. So I tease him about that whenever I get it. I said, David, I think of you more than anybody else in the world. But and so maybe Jacob had that situation where he's reminded of that instance with God and with the angel of God. And so we see these kind of events in your lives. And so Jacob is at the end of his life. He's been treated better, and in hindsight, he sees how God has been working through all of this, because now he is in Egypt. He is reunited with all of his boys. He has his entire family around him. And what is absent in this situation now that he finds himself in Genesis chapter 48? Jacob's situation. What's missing? Where are they? They're in Egypt, which means they're not where? They're not in Canaan. They're not in the promised land. But they're also not surrounded by who? The Canaanites or the Amorites, whose iniquity has already got God's attention. And so God has removed him and his children and his grandchildren from that evil and wicked influence. And I think to a degree Jacob recognizes that. You know, Jacob saw and could see how blessed he was from God. You know, why did Zacchaeus, still on this line of thought, why did Zacchaeus climb the tree? All he wanted to do was what? See the Lord, to get a glimpse of Jesus. What was Zacchaeus blessed with, though? Did he get to see the Lord? What else did he get? What actually happened? Yeah, what did you say, Ari? He got personal visit. He got blessed with friendship and salvation from the conversations with Jesus. He got intimacy with the Son of God, and all he did was climb a tree hoping to see him. And yet look how he was blessed as a result of that action. Bountiful. The windows of heaven were opened up for Zacchaeus, wasn't it? You know, ask for a gentle glance and receive an arm around us is what we get in response when we reach out to God. We reach for the hem of the garment, and he takes our hand warmly in his, thinking of the woman who had the issue of blood that was helplessly and hopelessly with no hope. And she just wanted to touch his clothes. And her faith made her whole. We approach as servants, and he sends us away joyously justified. And what we get to see here in Genesis 48 and 49 is an example of that principle. Because Jacob is getting ready to leave this earth joyously justified. And it's a beautiful thing, these chapters. They're beautiful in what they present to us. So when we look at what we have up here, does God bless only the worthy? No. Just ask Jacob. He knew he was not worthy for at the end of his life of all that God has given him. And hasn't he amazed you with his generosity? He has certainly amazed me in what he has done for Joni and I in our life together, and even before that in my life, my entire life. He has given me such generosity. Let's look at tonight 48, 15, and 16 to carry this idea forward. Genesis chapter 48, verses 15 and 16. Jacob is talking here now, as we've been discussing him. He blessed Joseph and said, "The God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads," and he's speaking of Ephraim and Manasseh here, the sons of Joseph. "Bless the lads," he says to the Lord, "and may my name live on in them." How proud he must have been to be able to see those boys. "And the names of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth." Wow. So not only was he able to see Joseph again, he was given so graciously this gift from God. Jacob was able to lay both of his hands on the heads of Ephraim and Manasseh, okay, and bless them with what we just read. And look at the blessing that he asked of them. He is asking Jehovah God to bless Joseph's sons with everything that God has done for Abraham, Isaac, and himself. Maybe because he wasn't able to do that for Joseph through so many years, because they were separated. And he wanted this to come and go to his boys. What a grandpa. What an amazing couple of verses there. He just demonstrates this gracefulness as he recognizes God's grace. All right, when we look through chapter 40, that's chapter 48, really. It all involves Jacob's last days, Joseph bringing in his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, in front of him, into front of Jacob, and Jacob blessing those boys. And so Joseph here, to his sons, receives a double portion. And I selected out just those few verses to read of his blessing, but that blessing really extends through the last half of this chapter. And Joseph tries to intercede. One little side point, Joseph tries to intercede at the very beginning of this when Jacob goes to pronounce, you know, individual blessings. And Jacob, in his feebleness or blindness, allegedly from Joseph's perspective, crosses his hands and he gets the boys. Joseph thinks he's got the boys confused with Ephraim and Manasseh, and which one was older was supposed to receive the one blessing. And Joseph stops his dad, tries to intervene and uncross his hands, and he says, "No, this is the way it's going to be." And so there's a little bit of an interesting aspect to the story there. But he says in verse 21 and 22, "Then Israel said to Joseph, 'Behold, I am about to die, but God will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your fathers. I give you one portion more than your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow.'" So when we talk about the 12 tribes of Israel, is Joseph in that list? No. He's one of the 12 sons, but he's never listed in one of the 12 tribes. So how do we account for this extra portion? Because who's listed in always in the 12 tribes? His sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So one would take the place of Joseph, and then there's Manasseh who gets an extra portion, and so we're back to 12, aren't we? Okay. And so that's where that 12 tribes of Israel actually comes from, is two of the 12 tribes are actually the two sons of Joseph. Okay, questions or comments on 48 before we get into 49? Adele? Well, I think it's in there were no nations individually to come from any one specific tribe. I think he's alluding to this idea of a multitudes of people, perhaps would be a better understanding of that. Certainly, Ephraim was a major portion and a major player in the tribe or in the nation of Israel. And I will say this, blessings are blessings. They don't always look like blessings to us. Ephraim eventually will take on a very, in our view of all the Old Testament scripture, a very negative aspect to Ephraim. Ephraim will become synonymous with the northern kingdom, which by and large was wicked, and Ephraim's descendants will have that nameplate, so to speak, of the northern kingdom and all of its wickedness that ultimately led to them going away and splitting from the southern kingdom and from the nation of the original nation of Israel. Okay, so perhaps there's an analogy or a reference in some of that to this, where in essence, Ephraim was one of the 10 tribes who made up the northern kingdom. But their name became synonymous of that. The capital city, Samaria, is actually on the border within the boundaries, I think, of Ephraim. Okay. And so there may be some reasoning behind that. Larry, you have any other thoughts on that?
Specifically as to the nations?
Yes, in verse 19 where it talks about the nations coming out, a nation blessing Ephraim that he would be the father of nations.
Yeah. My ESV has a footnote. It says, shall become a multitude of nations. And that word multitude could mean fullness.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's Israel will be full and unique amongst the nations. Again, you know, that it's an interesting, you know, obviously of the nations, they were the greatest nation. There were not other nations that would come out of Israel because Israel was the nation. Now, you know, so I don't know. It could be that in time they would bless all people, and you could take the third aspect of the promises to Abraham, that they would bless all nations, but that's not exactly the language here. So, but you do see nations in the three promises, Abraham with the fulfillment of Israel.
True. So Ephraim would have a portion in that sense of even the covenants and the promises to Abraham. And this carries that forward in essence. All right. Good. Yeah, that's a good point, too.
Me and Joe were talking after class last week about how it's interesting that Ephraim is the name given to the 10 northern tribes in a lot of the prophecies.
Yes.
That God uses. So God uses, like, the name Ephraim instead of to stand for all 10 tribes as opposed to Israel.
Right.
So in that way, you could say, like, Ephraim becomes all
right. 10. And that was the point that I was trying to make.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was that Ephraim becomes synonymous with the 10 tribes. Yeah, very good. All right, so when we get over into chapter 49, if we could just move into that chapter for the rest of our time tonight, we see in chapter 49, all the way through verse 27, the specific blessings of every son of Jacob. Okay? And so that's what you would read if we read all 28 verses. You would read each individual son and their blessings. And I just want to pick out a couple tonight to highlight them and to discuss. And the first one I'd like to look at, and before we get into Reuben is the example of this. Most of the blessings pronounced have a clear relationship to their character. And I think if you read through all 28 verses and looked at all those sons, you would see that kind of come forth. Jacob, this could not have been all that comfortable for some of these sons, because the old man, Jacob, is going to help them remember, lest they conveniently have forgotten what their personalities and characteristics are, and perhaps what they have allowed that to do in their past. So in a way, this chapter represents a judgment of these sons by their father. Do you hear the spiritual analogy that I just made? Judgment by their father of their actions. And what do they get as a result of that is what's here. And I think there is maybe some parallels for us to maybe think about a bit in that. But the one I want to start with tonight is Reuben. Who is Reuben? The oldest. Okay, so it's only fitting that he would be listed first here. Jacob goes that way. And so in verses 3 and 4, we have Reuben's blessing. Let's read that together. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my strength and the beginning of my strength, and the beginning of my strength, my might and the beginning of my strength. Preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power, uncontrolled as water. You shall not have preeminence, because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch. Wow. Here is the father condemning the son for the incestuous relationship with one of Jacob's handmaidens, the mother of some of his brothers. Okay? Reuben took a lot upon himself, it seems, because he was the oldest. He sought in his characteristics to have great dignity and great power in his presence, physical presence. Preeminent, he says, among his brothers, I think is the idea, in dignity and preeminent in power. But what does he say in verse 4 to him? He's what? What's his base characteristic? He's as uncontrolled as what?
Water.
Can I stand water over here in the corner? Can I like just take some water and put it over here and have anything and do anything? It has no real substance. There's nothing that holds it together, is there? I mean, it would just be a puddle. It wouldn't stand up. It's not like a 2x4. It doesn't have the strength of wood. It's uncontrollable. There's nothing you can do with it. Now, some people could say, "Oh, well, yeah, but water has great power." Not in this situation. Not in this reference. The idea is it just goes everywhere. You think you act like you have such dignity and such power. In reality, you got nothing. You know, you got no backbone. You got no substance. Is the idea here? So Jacob acknowledges his being, Reuben being his firstborn, that he's got power and he excels in honor. And he raises the specter of this incest that he committed because of this unbridled emotion, not being able to control himself. Just like a bowl of water is only controlled by the bowl it's in, right? It fits and molds to whatever shape of the circumstance. I think is the idea, is why Jacob brings that up. And that turbulence of that emotion would prevent him from further excelling in his future. And so to me, that reminds us as well, if those of us who lack self-control and who run from one attempt to another in order to excel, very often it's this desire of excelling that drives them to try to succeed evermore. And it turns into this treadmill of life. And if you know people like that, they hear of a person who's doing really well in some area, and that they wish to do the same. They wish to throw themselves into that endeavor and then excel more than that person. But because they lack self-control, they grow tired of that very quickly. And they're off to move on to another thing that captures their interest in which they can excel. What is the result of a lifetime of that? You ever hear the old adage that, you know, the mechanic's car is the worst maintained car in the neighborhood? Why? Because he's always working on everybody else's cars, right? A person who has this kind of mindset and lack of self-control is going to have a lifetime full of unfinished goals, unfinished projects. They'll have a multitude of projects at that 25 or 30% level, perhaps, but they never finish anything. There's no stick-to-itiveness with it. And it seems that Reuben was of a character such as that. You know, a dog that follows everybody is no good to anybody. And that seems to be Reuben. Isn't that interesting? And all of that seems to come out in Jacob's mouth, and he knows it. He has seen it, and he's laying that in Reuben's lap. Here is your blessing. All right. Let's look on then. Another one is the example of Simeon and Levi. Now, sometimes blessings don't always look like they're blessings. They actually read kind of like a curse. But in the reality of things, how is, and I'm using the name Jacob here, I probably should say, how is Israel viewing things through this chapter in his blessings? Is he concerned about, even though these are individual interactions with his sons, what blessing is really at stake here? The blessing of who? The future nation of Israel through these boys. Not so much them personally, but the blessings to the nation that are going to come from me, Jacob. Okay? And so look at Simeon and Levi's example in verses 5 through 7. Simeon and Levi are brothers. And we know that. They are. Their swords are implements of violence. Oh, have we not seen that? Remember the incident with Dinah? This is what this refers to. He's calling their sins up in front of their eyes. Simeon, Levi, your swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their counsel. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Interesting. What a blessing, Dad. Thank you so much for that blessing. If you were Simeon and Levi, would you feel better the rest of the day after gotten that from your father as your inheritance? But they've brought this upon themselves from their character, right? And how does God, through Jacob, tell us some things about himself? How does he view what they did on behalf of Dinah in that revenge? Holy? Unholy? Unholy. Unrighteous. Jacob says, I want no part of that glory and to be in their presence or be in their midst. When they have that kind of anger and can do that kind of violence to other human beings, they are wrong. You are wrong in that. And so how does God feel about people that have that kind of violence toward men and the slaying of men? God happy with men who slay men? No. Sanctity of human life is what's in primacy here. And not only that, but also property. Property of others, perhaps, of this idea of slaying the oxen. So Jacob says this curse in verse 7. Now remember now, this is a blessing to all of Israel. And we'll talk about that in just a second. But he says, I will disperse them in Jacob. Simeon and Levi, let's talk about their future a few hundred years down the road. What happens to the tribes of Simeon and Levi?
They're in place within Judah, and Levi is the priestly nation, so they have cities within all of
them. And that was the disbursement of the land was done how? Initial assignment of the land was done by lot, wasn't it? Providence of God involved. God gives Simeon this large territory, the southern portion of the land of Canaan, down toward the Negev, okay, southwest of the Dead Sea. But what's the problem with that? How much? Well, it's more than they could manage for the numbers they had. So they got given all this land, and because they couldn't handle the breadth of it, because they did it without God, or tried to, what happened to them? They lost their potency within that land. They were close to the Canaanites. They're close to Egypt. They're close to the Midianites and others. And they were constantly on the fringes of being imposed upon. And it's not very long, and there's a passage in the Old Testament that talks about it, where it says that Jacob basically subsumed or consumed Simeon. Okay? And so the area of Judah became really, they took over the influence that Simeon should have had in that area. Okay, and Judah becomes the dominant tribe in the southern portion of Canaan, which ultimately means why the southern kingdom became called Judah, right? Because they had all this territory. Well, originally, most of that territory belonged to Simeon. But Simeon was just watered down and really had no influence by that time. Very weak in their tribe. And they got separated from their partner in crime. Simeon and Levi were split up by God, weren't they? Because what did Levi get? They became the priestly tribe, didn't they? Which means they didn't even get any land, did they? They got 40 cities scattered all over the place between all the other tribes. So they had land given to them within cities, But the work they were given was very different than and their inheritance very different than what they got from what even Simeon got. So God splits these brothers up, and how is that a blessing? Was it a blessing to Simeon and Levi? No, not necessarily. But it was a blessing to who? All the nation of Israel. Because you didn't want your whole nation to have the characteristic of these two boys. Right? You had to water that out of there. Larry, you had a comment.
But there is a tremendous blessing for Levi in this sense that they would become the priestly tribe.
Yes.
And so, but it's not, you know, that's not spoken of directly here, but
right.
Indirectly.
Yeah.
What creates that for them is a blessing. And maybe in the idea of being absorbed into Judah, they end up being the faithful, the ones that hung in there the longest, I guess, maybe in the division. I don't know.
Well, here's the thing. Jacob says, you know, cursed be you with these things. And what they deserved to get was curses because of their actions and their murder, okay? But what they wind up getting, even though they were cursed people in their characteristics, they got salvation from association with Israel and what was happening through Israel. And especially Levi got tremendous blessing bestowed upon them by becoming part of or becoming the priestly tribe. Moses was a Levite.
And maybe I'm jumping way ahead here, but you know, the fierce anger, that's you curse yourself with that.
Mm-hmm.
But you later see with Levi a zealousness during the Exodus where they stood up against the immorality, and they were spoken of as being zealous for God. Maybe I'm getting the time element wrong, but there are some things where maybe that anger finally became controlled, and they were zealous and strong for God. I don't know. I'm really jumping at that one.
Right.
It's still it's interesting, but in the generations to come, yeah. That there's a righteous anger that could be described as zeal. It can be balanced in the Word of God.
And we see about all of these blessings, if you go back over to verse 28 in this chapter, whatever we come away with understanding these blessings, we have to apply verse 28 to all of them. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, every one with the blessing, watch these words, appropriate to them. This is their judgment day, in essence. And their father has given them his decision based on what was appropriate for them. Does that make a good gospel invitation? There is a spiritual analogy there for us. That there is going to come a day when our spiritual father is going to give us a judgment, and it's going to be rendered unto each of us as it is appropriate to us. You see that? I think we can pull that safely from here. All right? So when we wrap this idea up here, all this instruction for us is in this chapter. After we've said our piece, only God knows what a real blessing is. And Simeon and Levi are a good example of that. Is they deserved really a very strong cursing. And yet, they do receive through all of this tremendous blessing. And perhaps what they were given and what men might say is this lesser role actually becomes a way at which, yes, but that's all you can handle. And through you doing that, you actually achieve salvation for your people and became part of the children of God. And that's all that that's the only way you are going to and your descendants were going to be able to get in. And so God, in his love, is taking care of these children of Abraham, children of Israel. So in the final analysis then, What is a blessing and what is a cursing? Something is a blessing if it enables its possessor to better serve God and in this way find a richer, fuller life. Does that make sense? So what's a curse then? The way we look at curses should be, a curse is anything that hinders our service for God and in this way narrows or hurts our life with God. That should be our mindset toward blessings and cursings. Okay. A couple more things about this chapter. All the blessings in chapter 49, I believe, are connected to character. And in life, our most common question is, how can I succeed? You know, how can I succeed? We want to know that when we face things so often. But really, in light of reading chapter 49, what should our question be? Am I fit to succeed? Right? Am I ready to succeed? Am I prepared? Am I fit? Joe, I heard you. Yeah. And so, God gave Christ all power because He used whatever power God gave Him to help others to God's glory. And in Christ, and in this, Christ showed that He knew what power was for and that He could be trusted with it. Philippians 2, verses 5 through 11 talks about that. God finally found one in Christ who could be blessed with all power because He could be trusted with all power. So when we look at what God gives us, our question should not be, hey, I'm a three-talent person, or I got five talents, or I got one talent, and how can I succeed with this? We should first be asking ourselves, am I fit to have this? Am I prepared to do what God wants me to do with this? And then obviously get busy and do it. But that first question is very important, and is far more important than the second one. Now, let's look over at 22 through 26 to wrap this up. Here we see the blessings of Joseph. We can't really get through this chapter without looking at all. After all of this, what is Jacob finally going to say to Joseph after these years apart? Let's read verses 22 through 26. Joseph is a fruitful bough, by a spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him. But his bow remained firm and his arms were agile from the hands of the mighty one of Jacob. So Jacob there is giving the credit of Joseph's character and salvation to Jehovah. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, from the God of your father who helps you, and by the mighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast and of the womb. The blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, may they be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Isn't that beautiful? Up here at Carter's Mountain, you can stand up here and look to the west and you can see the utmost bound of everlasting hills, can't you? When you look west from there, you just see ridge after ridge after ridge after ridge, all the way to as far as your eye can see almost, right? That's the imagery here in verse 26, that Jacob is calling upon Joseph the blessings that are to the utmost bound of these everlasting hills and the crown of his head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Remember those visions that Joseph ran and told his father about when he was just a child? Remember that? And who was going to bow down to whom? And Joseph was going to have the preeminence, not Reuben. Jacob here is acceding to that very thing. And basically, Jacob is telling Joseph here in his last words to Joseph, your vision is true. Your vision is accurate. Isn't that amazing? It is so important for us to recognize. When we look at Joseph's willing submission to this 13 years of purgatory, or possibly longer, and the results that he gets from that in this rich blessing, it is amazing. Character is involved here, but the power to bless resides ultimately in God. And that is something we also need to remember. If you look over at 2 Timothy to close tonight, 2 Timothy chapter 2. Who can read 2 Timothy 2, 20 and 21? Who's got it? All right, go ahead.
But in a great house there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also of wood and of the earth, and some to honor and some to dishonor. Oh,
21 also.
Okay. If a man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor, sanctified and meant for the master's use, and prepared unto every good work.
So we see in verse 20 a reference to that, what I would describe as the word picture of what the children of Jacob looked like. These boys were what kind of pottery? They were all shapes and sizes, weren't they? They were clay, they were earthenware, some of them had some silver, some of them were gold. But through all of them, it's in verse 21, the emphasis is what? If you will cleanse yourself from the things of the world and from wickedness is the idea. You will be a vessel, whether you're pottery, silver, or gold, you will be a vessel full of honor, sanctified, and it keeps going. You'll be useful to the master, prepared for every good work. And that's what Jacob is saying his boys need to do. You know, Simeon and Levi, you may be a clay pot, but you need to prepare yourself for every good work because God has plans for our family, right? And so that kind of brings us to the end here of chapter 49. Larry?
Yeah, it's interesting that you take that verse and then you look at the blessing of Joseph. I think there's two occasions where you see the brothers in this blessing. It just appears to me that the archers that harassed him severely was his brothers.
Yes.
They were his opponents.
They shot arrows at him for years before they finally threw him in the pit.
Yeah.
Right?
And then, you talk about being set apart. I'm using the ESV here at the end of verse 26. It says, may they be on the head of Joseph and on the brow of him who was set apart from his brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ESV uses that idea of being set apart as 2 Timothy 2 talks about you being set apart for good work. So it's interesting of how Joseph built his life. He's now the rock. He is the one that's provided blessing to those who once attacked him. He's set apart to a very rich and powerful work. But he was so alone for so many years of that. And that should be a lesson to us. If we go down that path, you know, we try to choose that path of building gold, silver, and, you know, and building in a quality way, then it can be a lonely path for a while, but always the blessing is there at the end.
Mm-hmm. And the chapter winds up, once these blessings are finished, it winds up with Jacob receiving and demanding from all his sons a promise. And that promise is what to do what? When I die, what? Take me home. Take me home where?
To
back to Canaan. And there's a certain cave. It's interesting the way Jacob describes this. So just take a second to read it. I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field of Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah. There they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah. It's interesting because he says they, but Jacob is the one that did that. And there I buried Leah, the field, and the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob had finished charging his sons, he drew his feet up into the bed and he breathed his last, and he was gathered to his people. So my question is, who were Jacob's people? Who's he talking to him then about there? When you're at the end of your life, and you can, as Jacob, be blessed as an elderly person, and as you pass from this life, who and what do you have your mind on? Yeah. I will think about my children and those left behind. I will. I already do at certain times when I think about these things. I think about my girls. But you know who I will be thinking about then? It's the same as Jacob here. I'm going to be thinking about my mom, who I haven't seen since 1985. Because she died. I'm going to be thinking of my grandma, both my grandmothers. I know where they're buried. One is buried about an hour from here, and one is buried in a small family cemetery in Kentucky. And there's a line of that family in that cemetery in Kentucky that's many, many generations back. And then I think about this cemetery down in Chester, and it's full of my family. I have a cousin that's buried there that was less than a year different from me in age. Never met her. Because Karen died when she was an infant. Never met that cousin. But those are my people. And I'm going to be gathered to them someday. So when you ask, what's heaven going to be like? You know, there's glimpses and verses that tell us something about it. And this is one of those verses where it says that we're going to be gathered to our people. And there is there not comfort in that and beauty in it? And I think by extension, it's just not our physical families. It's really the righteous that we have hope to be gathered to. And that includes a lot of people, doesn't it? In this next world, you get to know Moses. You get to see Paul. You get to know Peter. You may have some questions. I don't know. We've always talked about it. While everybody else is rushing to go ask the Lord these questions, I'm going to try to pigeonhole Peter over here because I got a question that's always bothered me about something. You know, things like that. I think there's possibly that part of that is in this idea of being gathered to your peoples. And that passage in the New Testament talks about you will be, even then you'll be known as you are known, comes to mind. Jacob was a wonderful character for us to have given to us by God. Was Jacob perfect? Oh no. If there is a case study of a flawed human being, it's Jacob, right? It would have to be Jacob. And yet look at how we end our story of Jacob with this idea of being gathered to his people. And what a message of hope that is. Not just hope for him. Hope for us, because this flawed man could so learn the ways of God and so display it in this chapter of blessings to his son. He shows that he has mastered that idea. Adele?
So I just wanted to clarify something that I can't figure out here. This passage in chapter 49 is Jacob speaking to his sons as Jacob. He doesn't refer to himself as a messenger from God or or any kind of direct revelation from God. So what my question is that are these statements about his children prophecy that has been revealed to him by God, or are they simply traditional blessings that do the culture of the day?
I think God's hand is in this. I think they're prophetic. I think it's they're inspired. I do, and I would say, Larry, you might be able to rustle me up quickly a cross reference there about Joseph or Jacob being a prophet. But there are passages that render Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob on an equivalency as being prophets. Okay, you know, we come sometimes pigeonhole that idea of inspiration from God as a prophet into that. Well, they have to be like Elijah or Isaiah or someone, and that's I think we don't do justice to the full embracement of how God worked during the patriarchal age. Okay. And certainly Jacob was a patriarch, and he was prior to the law of Moses, and God worked with the heads of families directly. And so I think we get the benefit of that when we read these chapters and can have great certainty and confidence, maybe is a better word, that what we read here is in fact prophetic, and it's from God through them. He is speaking for himself, but he's also a spokesman for God, and that by itself is the very definition of prophet.
God, through Moses, wrote down these words to show his story and his thread for his plan for mankind.
True, but not every single person, though, who has their words recorded as like in quotes or a direct statement would necessarily be considered, well, they were inspired. Because some of those people would have been like wicked kings. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar, for instance, would just come pop in my head. We have a lot of statements of Nebuchadnezzar's that are written as like verbatim. But that doesn't mean that just because they're verbatim recorded means that, you know, in essence, you know, it's some sort of a prophecy or a statement that we adhere to God. But the Holy Spirit certainly provides that. So we have confidence in the accuracy that these words were said. I think Adele's question was pointed at was, where's the source of those words, man or God?
Well, the reason why I have that question is that Jacob never says this is coming from God. He never says, thus saith the Lord.
Right.
This is what the Lord revealed. Let me tell you what he said.
Yes.
He says, I'm going to tell you what shall happen to you in the days to come. Assemble and listen, O sons of Jacob, listen to Israel, your father.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
no, well, I mean, don't speed through that statement about he never credits God, because he credits God through everything he's saying here. There's lots of places where he credits God, okay? And remember verse 28. It very clearly says, he blessed them, everyone, with the blessing appropriate to him, okay? And so the Holy Spirit is putting this stamp of approval upon what Jacob has said by giving us that verse, okay? So, I don't think it is a... I don't think it is simply an old man gathering his sons and giving them Hebrew liturgy, these are the blessings that all fathers give all their sons. Because they're very unique and very telling. And we see fulfillment of these in the lives in the coming nation, many of them. Like, we didn't talk about Judah's, but when you look at Judah, verse 10, here is Jacob says to Judah, their blessing, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. Okay, the scepter, what is that? What does that represent? Kingship. The kingship, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. We know that Judah was what came from Judah, the kingly line. This is a reference to the kingship of David. Now, Saul was not from Judah, the first king, was he? So, because that was Benjamin. Saul was from Benjamin. So how does this come about? Because he's talking about the throne of David. Okay, is the emphasis in chapter 10. And the lineage ultimately that he's referring to here is whose? Jesus Christ. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. Whose tribe did Jesus come from? Judah. Right? So, and he says, until what? Finish the verse. Nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Jacob is prophesying about Jesus Christ right there. What is Shiloh? Until what? Peace. Shiloh means peace. Okay? So until full peace comes, and to him, that comer, shall be the obedience of the peoples. We will all bow the knee to that child of Judah. That's Jesus Christ. That's my understanding of that verse. So I think that one there alone is a very telling when you look at Judah's prophecy, for instance. Okay. That's a good question. It's worthy consideration. I think there are passages that we might look at where that question could maybe be more strongly argued about whether or not this passage is prophetic or not, or whether it's just insight with what this individual is saying. But that particular passage from Jacob in this chapter, I think, is pretty strongly indicating. I got some pretty good strength to say that this is prophetic. There's just too much in it that points to things that ties it all together in God's eternal plan. Okay, good conversation, good questions, discussion tonight. I love that. Challenges the brain, right? That's what Bible study should all be about. Okay, next week we will read through chapter 50, which is the actual death and burial of Jacob, including his Egyptian embalmment. And then we will do a review of the book. And I think we got a few interesting things maybe to bring out that we didn't cover as we ran through it the first time. Thank you for your attention. Larry?